Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm Brian Lanzone. On today's program, we visit an agriculture company in Salinas known as Andy Boy. It was named after a toddler in the 1920s who is now 89 years old. Andrew D'Arrigo's family is credited with introducing America to broccoli and green celery as commercial crops. He's now head of the family-owned company and chats with correspondent Tom Wilmer about farming in the Salinas Valley. Also, Chrissy Hewitt and Stephen DeLuque bring us part two of their Ears on Art conversation with artist and art instructor Barry France. They'll discuss his role in the expanding the facilities of the Cuesta College Art Department to include a sculpture studio and bronze casting foundry. But first, Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States, and more than 5 million Americans are living with the disease. Marisa Waddell talks with two experts about the disease, its warning signs, and what resources are available if you or a loved one has Alzheimer's.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Over 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's disease. That's one in nine seniors in the nation. And Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. September is World Alzheimer's Month. It's a great time to become aware of the resources that are available for people diagnosed with the disease and their loved ones. I have two guests today who can help us better understand Alzheimer's disease and what we can do about it. They are Donna Beal, who's the Vice President of Program Services and Advocacy for the Alzheimer's Association California Central Chapter. And that serves Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and Kern counties. And also with me, Jenny Moliner, who is the Director of Family Services at the Village at Sidney Creek Care Facility in San Luis Obispo. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about the Alzheimer's walks coming up. There are walks to end Alzheimer's happening all over the nation, and there are some coming up really soon in our region.
Yes.
There's one in San Luis Obispo on September 21st, another one in Santa Maria on the 28th, and another in Santa Barbara on October 5th. And Jenny, I understand that you've been involved in organizing the San Luis Walk.
Correct. And we're really excited to have it this year again at Laguna Lake in San Luis Obispo. We're hoping for, I would say, close to 600 individuals attending. And we are going to have a 3K walk. Mm-hmm. And then we're also throwing in just because a 5K run and a kids fun run. So we are actually expanding what the walk to end Alzheimer's normally looks like. And hopefully we will even bring more awareness and funds by making this a more productive event.
So that's the purpose of the walk to end Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. To raise funds and to raise awareness and to provide a family gathering that allows folks that have been through this journey to have a celebration as well for their loved one.
Okay. And if you want to find a walk to end Alzheimer's near you, just go to alz.org and there's a handy dandy little place where you can enter your zip code and it'll show you your nearest walk.
That's mm-hmm. correct.
So, Donna Beal.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit more about Alzheimer's disease. What exactly is it?
I always love this question because I think the best way to explain it is to give a little bit of a metaphor. When you hear the word cancer, you know what that means. And it's not until somebody says, I have lung cancer or breast cancer, that you then have a follow-up question. What stage? Mm-hmm. Well, dementia is like that word cancer. It's an umbrella term. It means a collection of symptoms. And then when somebody says, I have dementia, the question really needs to be, what kind? And mm-hmm. Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. Makes up about 70% of the dementias out there. Mm-hmm. With vascular dementia, which is usually connected to strokes, making up the next biggest percentage, about 17. Mm-hmm. And then all the rest, anything else you might hear kind of falls into that other category. So that's really, you know, what also, it's a collection of symptoms that truly affect a person's ability, their memory, their cognitive thinking, just all of that kind of stuff.
And why does it cause death?
When we think of the brain, it's an amazing organ. It's about the size of a head of cauliflower. It's about 2% of your body weight. And it does so much. You know, when you're born, you are able to blink. You're able to breathe. You don't think about it. You just automatically do it. Well, the brain handles that. So with Alzheimer's disease, again, because it's a progressive degenerative disease, eventually the parts of the disease that are affected are those places in the brain that handle swallowing, breathing, blinking, all of that kind of stuff. So what you'll find on a death certificate is aspirational pneumonia is the cause of death. That's the most common cause of death with somebody who has dementia or Alzheimer's disease.
Simply because they've lost their ability to swallow?
Yeah.
Okay. And that's probably something that you've seen quite a bit in your work at Sydney Creek is
absolutely
the later stages of the disease.
Right. And we have residents that are even earlier mid stages, depending upon what their family scenario is or what their progression looks like. And it's often bittersweet for the families that I work with because they know it's coming. It's been a long and difficult grieving process of watching someone usually pass slowly. And so it is very bittersweet when that time comes.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, Donna, what are the warning signs of Alzheimer's disease?
So there's 10 warning signs. And anyone who wants to find out more specifics, more real details, nitty gritty, if you will, you can go on to ALZ.org and in the search button type 10 warning signs, and it'll pull up an e-learning program that you can actually do that goes through in detail all the warning signs. Probably the ones that I get the most questions about, with where I work is, oh my gosh, I forgot my keys. Does that mean I have Alzheimer's, right? Or I forgot that it's Saturday, And so, with Alzheimer's disease, memory loss that disrupts daily life is definitely something to be worried about. It's probably the biggest one that we hear the most with. That doesn't mean you've lost your keys or you forgot that it was Tuesday. It's that you lost your keys and you don't remember that you've lost your keys, or that perhaps you don't even remember what this key is or what it goes to or how it's used. Mm-hmm. There's confusion with time and place. So they may think it's the summer when it's the winter. Another real big one that we hear a lot about or see a lot about, and of course I'm not going to get through all 10, but another real big one is that changes in mood and personality. Mm-hmm. You'll have somebody who happy-go-lucky 1 minute, and the very next minute, ooh boy, curmudgeon, And it can go the opposite way too. So there's a whole lot more to explore and to find out, and I definitely encourage folks to go online. If they have even an inkling of concern, go online. The e-learning program's 20 minutes online, and it's free.
Okay, and that's ALZ.org to learn more about the warning signs of Alzheimer's. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guests today are Donna Beal, who's the Vice President of Program Services and Advocacy for the Alzheimer's Association, California Central Chapter, and also Jenny Moliner, who's the Director of Family Services at the Village at Sydney Creek, which is a care facility in San Luis Obispo. We're talking about Alzheimer's disease. This is World Alzheimer's Month, and there are some walks to end Alzheimer's coming up, and we'll give you a little bit more details about those toward the end of our conversation here. Jenny, when someone has Alzheimer's disease, what can that person or others do to plan for it and know what to expect?
It's always difficult because someone with dementia, ultimately you've met one person with dementia. Mm. There is no cookie cutter dementia. So every scenario is very different. But I think the best thing that you can do is to not attempt to rationalize with the person that has dementia. Let them be right. And also to stay very patient. You are talking to a disease sometimes and not necessarily your loved one that you've known your entire life. And so it is where we kind of have to let our egos go. And someone that's diagnosed can often be very depressed, have a lot of anxiety, sometimes anger. And so whatever we can do as the non-diagnosed individual to make their life easier, that's the better thing that's going to keep the peace in the family, definitely.
So rather than getting impatient
yes.
with having to say something again, just say it again.
Exactly. And that becomes very difficult, especially if, a adult daughter, for instance, is the primary caregiver. It's hard to keep that three-ring circus going throughout the day and also keeping your cool, because most likely that adult daughter is also raising children still and is married. And so it's hard. And especially as ladies, we always try to keep everyone happy. And it takes its toll after a while.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the ways that caregivers and loved ones can cope with behaviors like wandering?
There's no way to generalize, but we do have lots of education that we can provide both online and in person through the course services that we have as a chapter. The online, again, is available at alz.org/care. Mm-hmm. And if you go there, we have a care center. And in that care center, we give you tons of information on behaviors, on stages, on how to have the conversation about driving, what are some tips to do on wandering, what are some simple things you can do in your home to help keep the person from wandering, and just so much more.
Mm-hmm. Jenny?
I typically encourage a caregiver to do as best as possible to take care of themselves, because you cannot be a good caregiver unless you're taking care of yourself. And to also ask for help from others, because so many caregivers become desensitized to what they're doing day in and day out that they don't realize the effects that it's having on themselves, thus really affecting their ability to take care of their loved one. So taking care of yourself is very, very important.
It's Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell with Jenny Moliner, who you just heard. She's the Director of Family Services at the Village at Sydney Creek, which is a care facility in San Luis Obispo, and also Donna Beal, who's the Vice President of Program Services and Advocacy for the Alzheimer's Association California Central Chapter. And that chapter serves Ventura, Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and Kern counties. You told us about some of the information that you have available on your website. What are some of the other services that the Alzheimer's Association offers?
The five core services that are available are the education, which I talked about, which is kind of three-pronged. We do professional education with continuing education units, family caregiver education, and then community awareness types of things. Another one, of course, is our support groups. I think those are fairly self-explanatory, you know, monthly groups that people can come to. And really, it's caregivers and adult children that can come and kind of share what's going on and get some ideas from other people who are walking the same path. We have our safety services, which kind of gets back to the question about wandering. And there's three pieces to that. We have the Medical Alert Safe Return bracelet, which is much like what you'd see somebody with diabetes wearing, mm-hmm. Which will help a first responder get their loved one back to you. There's Project Lifesaver, which is through the Sheriff's Department, which is a radio transmitter frequency bracelet that somebody can wear. And then, of course, there's our Comfort Zone, which is actually a GPS tracking device that can be put in a purse or a wallet or sewn into pants or, you know, whatever. And then we have information and referral, which if somebody just, you know, needs an elder law attorney in town, or who are the neurologists. And then the last one, which I think is the one that many families right now are using a lot, and that's our care consultation. Mm-hmm. I've had staff sit down with them with a full family, like, you know, daughter, son, spouse, sons in Michigan's on the phone, daughters in Hawaii on Skype, you know, that kind of thing. And they'll talk with them about what's going on, what's causing this, and they'll do some care planning with them.
Mm-hmm. Now, I expect also that it's important to find good activities for somebody with Alzheimer's and to have some kind of regular schedule, something that they can count on.
Mm-hmm. With activities, you know, I think it's important to understand that, as we've said, the disease is individualized. So the activities you're going to do are also going to be individualized based on the personal likes and dislikes of the person with dementia. However, with that said, I also think it's really important and imperative for folks to understand that there's something about the arts and dementia that's mm-hmm. amazing. Music does, I mean, think about a song. Where does it take you to? Mm. You hear a song and a memory comes back, right? And I'm not saying that it's going to fix the disease. There's no way to do that. It's progressive. But you can have those glimmers, those amazing moments that you can find that simplicity and the joy in the arts. And that's, you know, not just music, that's also art appreciation, looking at art. But you can also do simpler type things. If your loved one loved to knit, you know, Jenny being in the facility, she probably has like a ginormous list of things, you know, that she can go into.
You know, it is dependent upon the individual. And you mentioned knitting. We at Sydney Creek, we have a knitting club. I mean, that is long-term memory. And so those are skills that don't go away until very, very late in the disease process. And also, outings are very important for individuals that can still do that. Running errands, even going to the grocery store, or going out to eat, going to get ice cream, picking up the kids from school. Those are really nice activities for someone who has dementia. I can't encourage families enough to think out of the box. And, you know, you also have to think of, well, males like to do different things than females. This isn't just about playing bingo anymore by any means. And keeping that structure is also very important in keeping the day full and purposeful and challenging. You know, individuals with this disease can still accomplish and be challenged. And we all need to feel needed. And so we really try to focus on purpose and meaningful purpose at Sydney Creek.
Mm-hmm. And also showing up, being there, and showing love, even if the person with Alzheimer's doesn't know who you are.
Oh, totally.
Absolutely.
I always tell families, even if that person with this disease can't pinpoint what your exact title is, mm-hmm. all that matters is that you're on that family tree somewhere. It doesn't matter what branch you're technically on, as long as you're on that tree and that individual knows that you're important and that you love one another, that's all that really matters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They still feel that love.
Oh, absolutely.
It's World Alzheimer's Month, and we've been talking about the disease and what to expect and some things that you can do if you have a loved one diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. There are some walks coming up, Walk to End Alzheimer's in our region. There's one in San Luis Obispo on September 21st, one in Santa Maria on the 28th, and another one in Santa Barbara on October 5th. And these are fundraisers, and they're for raising awareness about Alzheimer's disease. You can find more about them at alz.org. All the details will be there. If someone wants to contact you, Donna, and find out more about what the Alzheimer's Association has to offer locally, how does one do that?
Call our 800 number. It's 1-800-272-3900. And the way the number works is between 9 and 5, Monday through Friday, you're going to get a local person. After 5 o'clock, however, and before 9, you will still get a live person, but it becomes our helpline. And then that live person will then respond back to the local office so that we know that you've called.
And Jenny, are you still looking for people to join the walk?
We're absolutely still looking for individuals to help support the cause. So if you have any questions about the walk, you can certainly contact the Alzheimer's Association, or you can contact me at Sydney Creek and I can address your question and help you sign up. My number at Sydney Creek is 543-2350. And I'm also more than happy to answer any questions or concerns that you might have about this disease process as well. My goal is to be a resource and to, ultimately support education and awareness for this disease as well.
Okay. Thanks so much. I'm Marisa Waddell for Issues and Ideas. My guests have been Donna Beal, Vice President of Program Services and Advocacy for the Alzheimer's Association California Central Chapter, and also Jenny Moliner, who's Director of Family Services at the Village at Sydney Creek, which is a care facility in San Luis Obispo. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX. Still to come on the program, part two of an Ears on Art conversation with artist and Cuesta College art instructor Barry France. We'll hear about his role in expanding the Cuesta College art department's facilities. France is being featured in an exhibit at the Campus Art Gallery this month. But up next, we visit an agriculture company in Salinas known as Andy Boy. It was named after a toddler in the 1920s who is now 89 years old. Andrew D'Arrigo's family is credited with introducing America to broccoli and green celery as commercial crops. He's now head of the family-owned company and chats with correspondent Tom Wilmer.
This is a story about two brothers who emigrated from Messina, Sicily to Boston, Massachusetts in the dawning days of the 20th century. Neither could speak English and neither had any technical skills, but one thing they did know was an intimate understanding of agriculture from their early days in the old country. After working odd jobs that included shoveling coal, they started their own small agriculture business, the D'Arrigo brothers. Eventually, one of the brothers headed out to California to secure grapes to export back to Boston. As the D'Arrigo brothers' operations blossomed in Salinas, California, they were the first to introduce broccoli as a commercial crop to America. Also, they were the first to introduce green celery. Incredibly, until the D'Arrigos introduced their green Pascal celery, all celery in America was white. Ever since I was a little kid in the mid-1950s, I always remember seeing a sign along the edge of the fields around Salinas that said, Andy Boy since 1927. Well, that sign's still there, and it turns out that I had the pleasure to meet Andy Boy, who's now 89 years old. Come along and join me for a conversation with Andy Boy, Andrew D'Arrigo.
My father and my uncle came over from Sicily as teenagers.
What year did they emigrate?
Before World War I, because they were both in the U.S. Army in World War I. They couldn't speak English, so they went to school and they tried to learn the language, and they took a job anyplace, whether it was shoveling coal for a furnace in a hotel or working in a shoe factory. They took whatever work they could get. They got their citizenship, and they went into the U.S. Army. When they got out, they went to work for their cousin. During those days, it was prohibition, so people were able to make, I guess it was 2 or 3 barrels of homemade wine legally. So it was a big business to get grapes from California and put them in a box and send them back to the East Coast where the old-time population was that made wine. So my father was sent out here to California to buy grapes. But my father being out here noticed the similarity of the climate to where he came from. And in the backyards of Italian people, he could see some of the vegetables that they had that he would recognize from his home. My father went out and got some broccoli seed from his father. My grandfather sent him the first broccoli seed that they planted.
And this is from Sicily?
From Sicily.
So broccoli did not grow or exist here in California?
In a very small way it did, but there was no seed company producing it commercially. My father made an experimental planting, shipped it to my uncle, put it in a railway express load, and went to Boston, and it sold very well. The people there had a little bit of what was known as homegrown during the summer months. It was seed that they developed themselves in the backyard, in the greenhouse. So then my father expanded it to additional acreage in San Jose, and the year after that went to Salinas. We moved the shipping office from San Jose to Castroville, where the Union Ice Company is.
And what year approximately was that?
Oh, that had to be maybe 30.
When he was in Castroville, was he again renting or contracting?
Yes, with growers. At that time, we did very little farming. We didn't have the money. Mm-hmm. Then over the years, it expanded to Salinas Valley, and one of the first growers he had was on this very land this office is now sitting.
And who was that?
That was Chester Chisholm, his father. He was one of our first growers. Also, we got into the lettuce business. My father got into the lettuce business during the beginning of World War II, 1941-42. My father died in 1951, and he was 57 years old. I was 2 years out of college that time. After getting out of the Navy, I went to college, I finished, and 2 years, then it was left to me. The first Pascal celery that came into this country came in with seed that my Uncle Andrew got from Nice, France.
Celery did not exist in California?
It did, but all celery was white.
How did it go from white to green?
Pascal celery, it was a light green, and it wasn't as stringy. It had more flavor, and it was fresher. My father started growing in California, and he and a fellow by the name Tavernetti grew the first celery in Salinas Valley. And they both were independent, not connected in any way, but they both started it in the same year. I can tell you about the Andy Boy label. In 1926, they began shipping broccoli with the Andy Boy label, and in 27 it became a registered trademark.
You're the genesis of Andy Boy then,
yes.
Right? How did that happen?
I wished I knew. Normally, in an Italian family, it's the oldest son, and I'm the youngest one. I used to tag along with my dad a lot. I was interested. Many times when I wasn't in school going Saturday, I'd climb in the car with him, get me out of my mother's hair, and have a little time out in the country. So I tracked pretty much what was going on.
So in 26 or 27, your dad decided to create that label, and they drew a picture of you then?
Yes. And this is the reason. When he shipped a Superior broccoli, and we put an Andy Boy label on it so it could be identified, what happened is that the local people at destination would buy the crate and put their own broccoli in it, which was inferior. So my father came back with the idea of putting a wrapper around it with the identity. And we even fought the fact that a lot of people would buy the broccoli and then sell the wrapper to somebody else who would iron it and reuse it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's what happened.
So the label was instituted in 27 then?
Yeah, it was instituted in 27, and that's what the trademark registered that you see out in the office. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
In what year were you born?
I was born in 24.
1924. So you were a little pup on the poster then.
Yeah, I was about 2 years old. And I can remember talking to my mother. When she saw the picture, she was upset because for the picture, she dressed me in silk rompers. And you can see I'm in coveralls there. So she and my dad had went out over that one. Anyway, that's where it occurred. I can't tell you why my father took me other than my brother, other than the fact that I just hung around with him so much. Mm-hmm. In order to overcome the problem of the label, all they could do was to identify the individual bunch. Now, what happened after that, they couldn't. But they also began advertising on the radio the product, and that contributed to the increased use of broccoli. Actually, I think they were the first ones to use advertising for fresh vegetable. Mm-hmm. In Boston, it would either be Faneuil Hall or in the produce terminal if it was in large enough lots. The smaller lots always end up in a farmer's type market. So anyway, during the 30s, my father ended up growing additional broccoli, fresh peas, tomatoes, cactus pears, Pascal celery. I can remember going, following the pea crop, starting in around San Jose area, and going up as far as Idaho for successive pea crops. Mm-hmm. Fresh peas used to be a big, big fresh produce item, and it was in, I guess, bushel baskets.
How did the cactus start? What started that?
This is a funny thing. I can remember seeing cactus when I was just a kid. I used to work in the packing shed on a Saturday. We used to pack the cactus pears. There was a lot of them in San Jose, mainly Italian growers. It was basically a product that the Italians knew and Europeans knew. But as time went on, my dad used to get them from the growers, pack them, and again send them back to Boston or New York for sale. But as that generation began dying off, the demand for it began falling off.
Over the years, it's evolved, and you processed the prickly pears, right, and create an end product right in-house.
Yes. We put up not only the fresh-packed pear, but a puree, which is used for dressing for margaritas, ice cream, any product that comes along that needs a puree. The last couple of years, we've been putting up pretty good volume of it. And we also are in what we call nopales, or the leaves, the cactus. Today, with the Hispanic population we have in this country, there's a good demand. I don't know any town that has over 10 people in it that doesn't have a Mexican restaurant. I think there is more future in it. It's a problem for harvest, though. I think that's what limits the amount of it. A tremendous amount of it is exported from Mexico.
Do you do the processing here?
In Gonzales.
And in retail, the label is an Andy Boy label?
It's sold under an Andy Boy label, yes.
And where would you find it? Nationwide?
Not so much nationwide, but mostly in Canada, where there are a lot of new immigrants. Hmm. And the East Coast, all up and down the East Coast, where there are second and third generation Italian and European families.
Some time ago, your daughter Margaret gave me a taste of it, and it was incredible. I loved it.
It's good, isn't it? It's a very good dessert fruit.
When I drive by here and I see all the loading bays that you have, I mean, that's incredible.
We load out 250, 300 trucks a day.
100% of your process now is literally done in the field.
Yes, all except the cactus pears. That's the only product that remains in the shed.
We've been visiting with Andy D'Arrigo, the namesake of the Andy Boy produce label since 1927. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Salinas, California.
And this is Public Radio KCBX, from the Salinas Valley to the Ventura Coast. Support for KCBX comes from Chaz Smith, the Dutch window cleaning artist, paying attention to all the details around your windows by cleaning in the Dutch way. Complete information is at DutchWindowCleaningArtist.com. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. She's the tattooed Lutheran pastor of the House for All Sinners and Saints in Denver. It's a church where the chocolate fountain, a blessing of the bicycles, and serious liturgy come together. She's a face of the emerging church, redefining what church is with deep reverence for tradition. Up next on Issues and Ideas, it's part two of Ears on Art conversation with artist and Cuesta College art instructor Barry France.
It's fun to have a vision, and it's even more fun when you can make it come to life. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I'm Chrissa Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program that Stephen DeLuque and I put together here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Today, we continue our conversation with artist and teacher Barry France. Last week, we learned that his primary material is clay, which he has used throwing on the wheel and also for sculpture. The avenues of sculpture then expanded through his work of developing a bronze foundry on the Cuesta campus. Today we learn about how that program was developed and also some fun history of how the art department started out in the bungalows on the backside of campus. Although he retired a few years ago, it is easy to hear in his voice that Barry has a real place in his heart for the art department at Cuesta College. Here now is part two of our conversation with artist, teacher, Barry France.
Talking about Cuesta more and more, and you made reference to the development of the foundry. You had the ceramics department going, and Chet was teaching painting and some drawing. You're trying to expand and get to develop actually physical space so that you can start doing sculpture?
I think it was in 1972 that the board, back before Prop 13, had a little more money, a little more discretionary funds, and they actually paid for this extension, which was above and beyond what the state had budgeted for the basic art department. So we got this wonderful sculpture facility added on to the original art building, and that's when I was able to start working over there, developing that program. And it was John Osborne that we brought down from San Jose State, who was a technician there in their foundry program, and he did a summer workshop. We built the primitive facility on our own using rusty plumbing and used bricks, and it never would have passed OSHA, but we got a foundry going, and fortunately no one was injured. And then we gradually replaced that as much as we could. Well, eventually it's all been replaced with modern, high-tech automatic ignitions and automatic shutdown and all the safety equipment.
You know what is needed in a foundry, but a lot of people don't. So this is a foundry for casting bronze, right, for the most part. So walk us through what some of the basic facilities need to be for that.
We do lost wax, so there has to be a facility for melting down the microcrystalline wax, which is a residue from the petroleum refining process. So we have an area for working wax, melting it, and pouring it out in sheets, which then is cut and welded with soldering irons and modeling when it's warm. That's the way you make the artwork. You have to have a wax original. That then has to be encased in refractory material, primarily plaster and sand, and gated so the metal can eventually funnel into that area once that wax is evacuated. It's called the lost wax process because the wax is evacuated by heating it in a kiln, a ceramic kiln, but it has to be a huge kiln because these investments, especially when you have several students working, adds up to quite an amount of material. So we have this huge kiln with a wheel-out floor so we can load the stuff up, push it in, and then you heat it slowly, very slowly, bring it up to temperature around 1,100 degrees and hold it there till all that wax has been flushed and burned. And then as it cools, you have to start preparing the bronze. And that requires a melting furnace, which heats the bronze to around 2,200 degrees, which is really hot. You need all this protective gear, reflective and insulated material and big steel tongs and tools to lift the crucible out full of bronze. In the meantime, the investments are unloaded from the kiln, buried in sand. You have a sand pit that has to be shoveled out. I don't know how many times I've shoveled that sand out. And then you put the pieces, shovel the sand back. Careful not to get any sand inside the cavity where the bronze is. And then that hot bronze is poured in. The sand is there to reinforce it because the pressure of that hot bronze could cause it to a fracture, and that's not good. Have 2,200 degree bronze running around on the floor. It's a beautiful process.
It is.
It has to be done very carefully. Once you get the bronze poured, you're halfway done. Then you got to knock this thing apart, pull it out and see what you've got, and then start cutting off the excess sprues and grinding and polishing and patinating. And it's a long process, very laborious, hard on the knuckles, hard on the back, but it's beautiful.
I took this class 4 or 5 times at least and was there in the very early stages when John came. And it's really an amazing facility. We have some other bronze casting professional facilities in this county that you can take a model to and have them cast it for you. But to my knowledge, this is the only school facility in a lot of places where you can go and actually learn how to do this.
Santa Barbara City College and San Jose. UC Santa Barbara foundry was shut down when that faculty person left. San Jose City College has a good program, but between there and San Jose, we're the only place where you can actually get involved and participate.
We talk about heavy lifting and tiresome, dirty, sweaty work, and you talk about plaster and sand being mixed together to make this investment that encases the wax. I always loved the term lost wax casting. It made it sound like some ancient something.
Sounds
out of,
mysterious.
You know, whatever.
Like a lost continent.
Exactly. When I was out there, we were using leftover sand and plaster as part of the mix. So you'd have fresh sand, fresh plaster, and what did they call the other stuff?
I don't remember.
Okay. Well,
we had to grind it.
We had to use heavy bars with plates on the end and try to stamp it. We'd, see if somebody had a pickup truck that could come in and run over it for a while, and you'd try to get this stuff down to be pulverized so that you could mix it. And it was like, oh.
Really high tech.
High tech. And hey.
It's because materials are cheaper here than labor. If you have cheap labor, they still use that. Mm-hmm. One of the visiting artists who had been in Italy, he said, they're still using some of the same material that Michelangelo used. They just keep re-grinding it.
I don't doubt it. But now I believe at Cuesta they're using a process called a shell. It's a little different method of encasing the wax.
That's a thin-walled ceramic shell, and it's very hard. It still has to be rammed up in sand to protect it. But I never got into that because it takes all day to build up one of those. And we have to get this done within the period of the class. And the plaster, you pour it in, you're done. That takes all day long. You also have this problem with silica dust flying around, and we didn't have a proper facility to evacuate all that dust. And I thought, it's not healthy. It takes too long. And the advantage is that it gives very precise detail. But it's also so hard, if you have any undercuts on the surface of your wax, it gets embedded in the bronze eventually, and you can't get it out. So I never was that keen on it. It's an industrial process. It was invented for making bronze propellers for submarines. It's a very precise thing, and industrially it has great application, and for some art. Well, especially if you make the art with a mold. If your wax is generated from a mold, by definition, there you have no undercuts, or the mold won't come off. So if you're making your wax original with a mold, of course, then it's not original, it's a multiple. And I always encourage making unique pieces, one-offs. So there was a lot of conflict in my mind about whether this was the thing to do. And it was mainly the health thing and the time issue that I decided made it impractical for a studio application at Cuesta College. But most places do it. I don't know how they solve the problem. Well, I've seen it done pretty badly, actually. I think we did the right thing by doing the standard plaster investment. It's safer.
And it's except on your back.
Well, yeah, it's heavy. It's darn right. Yeah, and I had a back operation right after I retired.
Since I own a jewelry store downtown, we send off our platinum casting pieces because it just requires so much heavy machinery and high temperatures and things like that. And they use porcelain casts for the platinum casting, the company that we send it to, because the platinum will just blow out plaster.
The jewelry casting is just a miniature version of what we do large. Mm-hmm. And I did that in college, too, although we used some dental plaster, or it's a high temperature plaster, but it's a very similar process.
Mm-hmm. Well, the interesting thing is how those three disciplines, the dental industry and sculpture and the jewelry industry, all have this connection. Mm-hmm. And the dental industry needed, of course, very precise castings. Thing had to fit in the hole that they had carved. So what happens in the process is, if you're basically just making a piece of jewelry, there's a considerable amount of shrinkage. So they were developing investments with certain kinds of plaster and stuff to try to really minimize that amount of shrinking, and also, of course, to keep the detail. And then they were also, as I understood it, developing waxes with much lower carbon content, so they would burn out cleaner, so that you had fewer pits and all of that kind of stuff. Here again, we go back to the balance, and we've got the industrial world. And obviously, if you're making a propeller for a submarine, you don't want to be sitting there trying to pour an investment around it if you're much of any of us. So you can certainly see why people are coming up with alternatives.
You're listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas. Our guest today is Barry Franz, artist specializing in clay and sculpture, and quite importantly, the second faculty member hired for the art department at Cuesta College. We have been discussing Barry's development of the department's bronze foundry. We continue now as we discuss how some of this works, and then take a trip down memory lane of the beginning days of the art department.
The way that that class was taught, I also thought was very helpful, which was basically an all-day Friday. I mean, you got out there at 9 in the morning or 8, and you worked all day. And, of course, you were working behind the scenes, firing the pieces for a couple of days before that so that we could pour if we were ready that day. But in the meantime, we were working wax and investing. And I remember one particularly cold day, and we're sitting in the wax working room, and everybody's kind of wishing that they were someplace else. And you kind of stormed in and went, "Come on, folks, this is wax. It's not a slab of marble. Just get in there and, you know, get it warm. Put it in some hot water. Do something." It was just kind of like, "Oh, thank you."
You can make a mistake and correct it easily.
It was saying, this is a material that you can be much freer with than you're trying to be in terms of exploring texture, exploring all sorts of ways of bending that almost quarter-inch sheet of wax, which is certainly pliable, but if it gets hard, it doesn't bend as easily.
Temperature is critical.
You know, here we were cutting and assembling as though it were cardboard, and Barry comes in and goes, "Hey!
Stick it in the hot water." Temperature is critical. You know, wax can either crack or it can melt. You've got to control the temperature. When you try to weld something together, if it's too warm, it'll just fall off. If it's too cold, you'll never get it stuck. You got to work with the temperature. And it's like with ceramic, it's the water content you have to worry about, whether it's too hard or too soft or whether it's going to join or fall apart. With wax, it's temperature.
And the other fun thing about that was, if we're talking about making connections to other disciplines and processes, when we were pouring those sheets, then exploring what happened if on this slab of plaster that we could pour wax onto and made a little lip around it so it would be the right thickness, that you could carve detail into that, and the wax would go into those details and then give you a sheet that had texture. But of course, that sheet was now a reverse texture of what you had...
Kind of like printmaking.
Exactly. So, you know, it comes off the reverse, and now we have dimension to it, so what was a hole in the plaster is now a projection coming up in the wax, and so that was a fun thing to explore, too, in terms of having to think backwards.
These are all things that you don't get if you're thinking of mold making, you know? So many people make a sculpture out of whatever material they're comfortable with, but the bronze is simply a mold taken off of that and replicated in bronze, but they don't get to experience the wax, which is something which is very pliable and tactile and has all kinds of possibilities once you explore its own potential.
Makes your hands soft after a while, too, at least that stuff, because it certainly, as you say, is a petroleum-based material. So how many years now has that program been going? Because to my knowledge, it's still going pretty strong, isn't it?
Well, when I started there in 67, Chet had this funky little kill outside the old mess hall, which was the sculpture room. And I taught it out there one semester, and I thought, this is too dangerous. I'm not going to do this anymore. And so we quit, and it wasn't until we moved into the new building, and I believe it was 1972, that we built the new foundry. And been going all along ever since. I keep worrying about it being shut down. People think it's very expensive to operate, but then when they look at the cost of the heating of the whole facility, it's minimal. It's very little compared to the operating of the facility as a whole. So it's still alive. I think they still support us. They recognize it as a very fine art department, appreciated and supported by the community. And it's a good public relations instrument for the school.
You're talking about the old Camp San Luis buildings.
Yeah.
That was across the creek from where the current campus is, and I think you might want to explain about that. These are old World War II barracks buildings that you guys were using.
Yeah, back then it was pretty rustic. They were old concrete slabs with wooden structures that were, you know, already condemned, I think, when we moved in, but we continued to teach in them for a long time.
You and the termites.
Yeah, the termites, yeah. The ceramics room had a space heater overhead that was blowing on the back of my neck, and often I would be standing in water in the wintertime. It was a flood. It was an old men's latrine, and they took out one row of toilets and put in the pottery wheels, left one latrine in the back. And they had a little overhang, a little shed on the back where we put a kill, and there was a big old sink where we could do the glazing and all. It was really rustic, but, you know, it was so free. Well, we did things that we could never do today. We went down to Lompoc and bought a whole bunch of second diatomaceous earth bricks that they were manufacturing down there. In fact, they gave them to us. And for years, we would build kills and tear them down just as a class project. And we would plumb them with old used galvanized pipe that we'd find, you know, over in the maintenance yard that they'd ripped up somewhere, build our own burners. The students learned at that time how a kiln worked. Now it's all so high tech. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on. It was a lot of fun, really a lot of fun. Strangely enough, I met a guy up in the Sierras at the top of Mono Pass and started talking to him. It turned out he was a CCC guy, instructor, and he said, oh, he taught in San Luis Obispo. The building that we had as a sculpture lab was his building when he was there. All those art buildings now have been replastered, and they're being reused current usages, including the County Historical Society, uses the old office and the ceramics building as their warehouse, and I don't know what all they do in there, but it's all plastered and connected with another wing between the two. Those buildings are getting a lot of use.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say, some of the nonprofits are out there, too. Some of the like court-supported nonprofit agencies have offices in those buildings now as well.
Well, I think it still belongs to the National Guard, mm-hmm. and they lease them or rent them at a very reasonable rate. I think that's how Cuesta got going. They leased all that stuff very cheaply, but they bought somehow the property from the creek out to the highway and knocked down all those buildings and built a new campus that's still surrounded by National Guard, mm-hmm. which is kind of strange sometimes. When the students rioted in Santa Barbara or Isla Vista and burned the Bank of America, mm-hmm. I went out to Cuesta the next morning, and there were machine gun placements in the entrances to the campus and concertina wire between the military base and the campus. It was like they knew that we were going to riot and do something.
When I first arrived at Poly, the ceramic program was out at the edge of the baseball field. Mm-hmm. So they would have balls coming into the area, and so they would scrounge and put up screen to keep that from happening, and then they were building the glass facility out there. But it definitely was a different kind of time, because the maintenance crews had a different kind of freedom to just kind of mill around campus and get to know people. And we have a whole pile of bricks over there that are just, do you want some? You could make mm-hmm. a flooring. Wow, okay. There was a lot of kind of wonderful scrounging, and I had the feeling that probably that was happening for you at Cuesta as well, in terms of just, as you say, building as you go and making something work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we knocked the wall out of the end of the ceramic room and put in some old windows we found stored over by the maintenance room and lit that place up so you could see what's going on in there. Yeah. And somebody brought it up at the Board of Trustees meeting once, and I think it was Bart Luma said, could you come over and do some remodeling on my house? And we had those funny things they called hutments. They had all these little things that were for bunks. They were about 10 by 10. Mm-hmm. They were scads of those things. They were selling them to people all around the county. They're still out in the ranches as sheds and stuff. And we had eight of them put in a circle or a quad behind the ceramics room. And so we had studio spaces out there for people who wanted to do some big sculpture. And we had the plaster room out there, so it's kept separate from the ceramic room. I had one out there. I could go out and work. It was wonderful. I'd get the students all set up in the classroom and said, all right, I'm right outside. Mm-hmm. Come out and watch, talk. It was great. It was just wonderful. You don't have that kind of flexibility anymore.
I think the building that was used as a lecture hall, the little theater, used as their location for about 8 years back in, well, it would be probably the 80s, the early to mid-80s. They set up their theater out there.
I took that class too, so I learned how to make sets and mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. That was kind of fun. I grew up across the street from the old Republic Studios that mm-hmm. filmed all the movies and stuff, and so we would see the facades of streets. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun learning some of the tricks of that trade. So now you're retired, and you've got a studio here, so is most of your time spent just kind of having fun with that, or anything other special, still traveling?
Off and on. I don't push it. I haven't found a venue around here which is really appropriate for the kind of stuff I do, and I'm not one to go hustling down to L.A. and up to the Bay Area. So I make what I'm interested in making, but the scale has gotten smaller. Space is a premium. You know, all my cupboards and things are full of artwork now. So I make stuff, but I also have an addiction to fixing up old Alfa Romeos, so there's usually one of those around taking up space. I started doing photography, abstract kind of compositions as I go out and hike. I hike a lot, and I take the camera along and take shots of water reflections and stone patterns and things. Not really landscapes, but I stay busy. Yeah, that's just... I used to do my own house maintenance, although I'm getting kind of tired of that. It's sort of getting impossible anymore. But when we did this house, I did all the finish work and built a lot of the custom features in myself. So I've been busy.
Amazing. It doesn't seem to take much to fill up the days. And I think that one is very fortunate if one has something one loves to do. Retirement is only retiring in terms of that formal job.
It's not like going to bed. In fact, most people I know they find themselves busier once they retire than when they were working. They had put so many things aside, so much to catch up on. They just can't believe how busy they are, but how enjoyable it is, too.
Do you and Barbara get to travel?
I've traveled all my life, and we've traveled together a lot. Last year, it was our 50th wedding anniversary, and we did a formal tour over to the El Camino de Santiago, de Compostela, and did a real leisurely walk of a section of that road with four-star hotels and a big fat bus to make sure we got where we were going and got back to the hotel. It was wonderful. It was really wonderful. Great food. And we went to Sweden and bought a Volvo there, took possession of a Volvo there as part of that trip. I've been to every damn place, just about. Traveling third class, hitchhiking. You know, I got one sabbatical to travel around the world to study the non-Western arts that I'd been teaching out of a book. And that was a great adventure in 1993. Brought back lots of slides, lots of experiences, and a lot of artwork resulted from that experience. Those sabbaticals are just wonderful opportunities to enrich your life and enrich your teaching, what you're giving to the students. We're talking about going to Quebec this next year, maybe. Someplace we haven't been and different than where we've been, so we're still thinking of travel. But
I'll recommend the Canadian train.
Yeah?
Great way to get there.
It's just awfully nice right here, you know. It's always nice to come back to San Luis Obispo. It makes it harder to leave, you know, that when you come back, it'll be better than where you went.
I have to keep reminding myself that people actually pay money to come here on vacation.
Exactly. Yeah, we're so fortunate.
Well, Barry, we're really going to look forward to seeing this exhibit, all three of them, as a matter of fact, and we had a nice time interviewing Chet Amix and his wife, Gyla Amix. We'll talk to Bob Pelfrey and round out the trio.
I appreciate your interest because I think we were a significant impact out there at the school and on the community, laid the groundwork, and great people have followed and continue to build the program. It's been a good life.
I think you're accurate on that one, so thank you very much.
Thank you, Krissa. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you very much.
Our guest this week and last has been Barry Franz, retired professor from the Cuesta Art Department. Next month, we will have a two-part conversation with another of the faculty, Bob Pelfrey. Here is co-host Stephen DeLuque to explain the timing for these two interviews.
Barry, along with Chet Amix and Bob Pelfrey, are being honored with shows at the Cuesta College Art Gallery to coincide with the 50th anniversary of the founding of Cuesta College. Chet Amix's show is currently running through September 20th. Barry Franz's show is September 27th through October 11th. And Bob Pelfrey's show runs October 18th through November 8th. The gallery, which is located on the Cuesta College campus, is open Monday through Friday, noon to 4 p.m.
It probably won't come as a huge surprise that due to many budget cutbacks, the gallery, too, is struggling. Faculty and students under the direction of David Prochaska are working overtime to make it all happen. Fortunately, the Cuesta Foundation has been willing to set up a separate account just for the gallery. If you're interested in details about this, please contact either the Cuesta Art Department or the Cuesta Foundation. This month has been Barry Franz. Next month is Bob Pelfrey. And no, we did not forget Chet Amix. If you go to the KCBX archives under Ears on Art for May 2nd and 9th, 2012, you can listen to our interview with Chet and his wife, Gyla.